Well, darn the luck. They have to go back to Bordeaux, Budapest, you know. I can think of worse places to just have to visit.
If you need an assistant, we're
available. Yeah. We'll take the show on the road.
Hello, everyone. It's the Two Boomer Babes.
Do you wonder if your elderly parents are still competent to drive, manage their finances, or even vote?
We'll talk about the ethical dilemma surrounding the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease.
Then, how to connect or reconnect with your partner in a flash without speaking a word.
Plus, what's left for a career diplomat after the glamour and intrigue of serving abroad? Why not write a mystery series?
And the universal language of swearing.
When someone is diagnosed with mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease, a Pandora's box of ethical issues springs open. What are the implications of sharing this information? Sharing it not only with family members, but also with employers or insurance companies. As the disease progresses, there are concerns about the person's capacity to drive and make sound financial decisions. Even voting can become an issue.
Joining us to sort through these questions and more is Dr. Jason Karlowish. His clinical practice focuses on the diagnosis and treatment of persons with Alzheimer's disease and related disorders. He's also a professor of medicine, medical ethics, and health policy at the University of Pennsylvania and a fellow at its Institute on Aging. Welcome to the program, Dr. Karlowish.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Can you briefly explain the difference between mild and moderate Alzheimer's? I mean, are there certain symptoms that differentiate one from the other?
Yes, there are actually certain signs that differentiate one from the other, and those signs are measures of the severity of the patient's disability. In particular, what we focus on is the severity of the patient's impairments and their ability to do what are called instrumental activities of daily living. And I kind of think of those as the things that you need to be able to do in life to get out of your parents' basement and become a successful young adult. So managing money, managing medications, managing transportation, cooking, cleaning. Those instrumental activities of daily living are the first things that are often impaired when someone's developing Alzheimer's disease dementia. And the way we decide someone's mild versus moderate is the severity of impairments in those IADLs, as we call them. And in moderate stage, they start to have problems, what we call the basic activities of daily living, which I like to describe as the things that get you off to sort of kindergarten, namely the ability to get up, use the toilet, wash up, dress, bathe, and eat a meal. Those things start to get a little bit impaired in the moderate stage, and so that's how we decide whether someone's mild or moderate.
When a doctor suspects that there is cognitive impairment but is not really fully prepared to make an official diagnosis, you know, not to give this awful news to the patient, but that must also present an ethical dilemma in and of itself, correct?
Well, sure, yeah, because the issue that you're getting at here is diagnostic disclosure. And when do you decide after you've done an assessment that you should tell a person that they have the diagnosis of Alzheimer's? My basic point would be that the default is you tell them, but there are some steps you need to take in order to get to that disclosure.
Well, say a person gets a diagnosis, you as a doctor give it to them, but they don't bring along any family or friends. Does the doctor then leave it to the patient to tell the family, or doesn't that present an ethical dilemma too? Because what if the person can't really make plans or take care of themselves and nobody knows about it?
Or just doesn't want to disclose to a family member?
Yeah, a couple issues there. It's pretty unusual to have a patient who has Alzheimer's disease, that is to say they're disabled, and to not have them seeing you in the company of someone else. Let's just assume that that was the case. It'd be hard even to make that diagnosis because, of course, you need the history from other people to tell you about those disabilities that stage them as mild or moderate severity. And patients often lack an awareness of their disabilities, and you really need that knowledgeable informant, that family member, to let you know that, yeah, I'm seeing troubles with the way he manages the money. He's getting confused while driving. Having said that, if the patient is saying, I don't want family to know, my response to that is, this person by definition has disabilities. They're demented, okay? They have Alzheimer's disease, mild or moderate stage in this case. And they're going to need someone else to help them manage those disabilities. So I have a real ethical warrant to bring other people in out of a beneficence-based obligation to help this person who's disabled. And so my challenge is to set the patient to see that.
But the doctor-patient privilege prevails, right? You really can't go over their heads and tell the family member.
Well, again, I'd want to know why the patient's not wanting the family member to know. I mean, there may be particular family members they don't want to know, but I at least want to know that there's one family member who knows, who is also a person who is there to watch over and help the person with their instrumental activities of daily living. So they don't have to tell everyone in the family, but at least I want them to make sure that there's someone who's watching over them who knows about the diagnosis. And I can usually get an agreement on that role, that trusted other person, a spouse, an adult child, a friend. But no, I agree. There's no, you know, warrant that they must tell all family, for example.
How does a medical professional gauge if a person is competent or not?
Well, we're kind of thinking about a very important point here, which is the need for what we call a task-specific assessment. So a couple very basic issues. Just because someone has a diagnosis of Alzheimer's doesn't mean that they are not capable of doing the tasks you listed out. That is to say that they're not competent to do those tasks, in a word. What's incumbent on a competent professional, if you will, is to do a task-specific assessment of a person's ability to do those things. And you can kind of break those tasks into two kind of broad categories. One are tasks that, you know, are really performative. In other words, how just do it and let's see how it goes. And I would put driving or believe it or not, the task of voting as an example of that. You know, when the person does it, do they do it well, and, or are there mistakes? In contrast, some competencies are about decisions. Can the person make a decision, like a decision about, say, investing sensibly or eating well? And that is to say, can they solve a problem, if you will? The challenge is when they have a problem but are unable to solve it. They lack the ability to sort of think up a solution, have someone help them with their finances. That's a problem.
You're listening to The Two Boomer Babes with Barb and Kathy. We're discussing the ethical dilemma surrounding a diagnosis of mild to moderate Alzheimer's. Our guest is Dr. Jason Karlowish. What do you recommend when a person diagnosed with Alzheimer's refuses help from family members and continues to drive, for instance? I mean, that is one of the toughest things.
Yeah, that's a very common case. Driving's a right, not a privilege. And that's an important point where society has stepped in to give the physician and, frankly, the patient and the family some guidance, and you have to earn that privilege. So when there's contention on the part of the patient about stopping driving, I, as a physician, have an obligation to really kind of cut a deal. And the deal is this. You need a driver's assessment. That is to say, either from the state driving authority or from a private driver's rehab facility to get behind the wheel and have them watch you drive. That's a performative competency issue I was talking about earlier. And let's let the results of that objective assessment decide whether you can drive or not. If the patient resists that and says, I don't want to spend the money, I don't want to do that, I say, well, how much would you spend to maintain the car if the car was broken? You know, so you spend the money to make sure that your car is working, you'd spend the same amount of money to make sure the driver can do it. And if they don't agree to that at that point, in my state, Pennsylvania, I have an obligation to report people who have impaired driving. So at that point, I say, well, you know, then the state will take care of this now because I need to report you to the state driving authority. It's a bigger challenge if you're in a state where you don't have the obligation to report, but I still think, well, states still do expect you to report an impaired driver. So I've got a couple of layers, if you will, of steps to take where, you know, if we can agree on an eval, if not, well, then I'm going to need to report you. Of course, one of the challenges there is some patients say, well, I'm not going to come back to you. And, you know, sometimes you face that problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, Kathy and I are smiling at each other because, you know, I went through this with my dad.
Right.
And he did the whole driving assessment thing and he failed. And it was so humiliating for him on a human level,
yeah.
You know, to watch that process where he took this test and then he fails it. And then he knew what was going to happen. And then they had to report him to the DMV, and
yep.
He lost his license. But I think that was the worst thing for my dad in this whole horrible disease, was losing his driver's license, which meant losing his independence.
Exactly. And as a clinician, I'm very aware of that. And therefore, for example, you want to prep the family to know this could potentially be the source of a lot of negative emotion, even depression or anxiety, which, frankly, you know, we'll need to address, behaviorally or otherwise.
Dr. Karlowish, let's just ask you about a scenario. Say Mr. Jones has been diagnosed with mild Alzheimer's. He's very aware, however, of what's happening, what's going on, and knows about the progression of the disease. Say he's a chief engineer, he's managing a big project. Should he actually tell his employer? Should he disclose this and really kind of be at risk of being laid off or fired? Or should he just continue to do his job as best he can, as long as he can?
Yeah, that's a tough one. A lot of it's about the job, you know, in other words, and the nature of the person's disability. So, for example, suppose the nature of the guy, of Mr. Jones's disabilities as a result of his Alzheimer's disease were in visual spatial function, and his engineering job involved a lot of the need to look at diagrams and charts. You know, you could make an argument there that he's beginning to have a disability as an ability to do his work. At that point, the Americans with Disability Act is a very important federal legislation designed to try to provide people reasonable accommodation in the workplace so that they can continue to work recognizing their disabilities. You know, so maybe he might not be able to be a project director anymore, but there might be other aspects of the work that he can do in the firm that he could do. It's a little bit of a challenge in Alzheimer's because of the progressive nature of the disease. Having said that, because we diagnose people oftentimes quite early and progression can be quite slow, I can think of a case such as this one where you could imagine, you know, under ADA accommodations, the person could have reasonable accommodations to continue some aspects of their work and also be protected from the risk of losing their job because of simply disclosing the diagnosis to their employer.
Now, what about insurance? What if you learn about this diagnosis and you want to buy life insurance or get that long-term health care policy? But, you know, if you divulge your condition, you'll probably, I mean, I think you will be denied. So what are you supposed to do? Is there any way around that?
Well, certainly you'd either be denied and or charged a high premium with a diagnosis like Alzheimer's. And so I think, and insurers have that right. I mean, that's called underwriting. You know, particularly long-term care insurers have that right. So it, I think, all the more emphasizes the need to kind of think about planning ahead of time and not waiting until diagnoses and problems arise, because you really don't have redress under the law to say, you know, I was denied my long-term care insurance because I have Alzheimer's disease. That, unlike health insurance, where you cannot, a pre-existing condition cannot deny you health insurance, that is not the case with long-term care insurance.
Well, I guess the lesson there is we should all run out and buy long-term care health insurance right now.
Well, maybe, maybe not. I mean, you need to look carefully at the policies. Do they really provide the kind of benefits you expect? What is your own savings and ability to pay for long-term care? I'm not saying that long-term care insurance isn't a good idea, but I'm saying that the devil is in the details about a policy in terms of just how much and what does it cover and in what setting.
Dr. Jason Karlowicz, Professor of Medicine, Medical Ethics, and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania, thank you so much for being with us.
You're very welcome. It's a real pleasure. It's a great time to talk about these topics.
Up next, relationship repair without speaking a word. Stay with us. Support comes from Accent on Travel Rehoboth Beach with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
During a heated conversation with your partner, do you ever get so mad that you can't think rationally? Perhaps you say things you regret afterwards, or you think of a really good comeback the next day. When your own words fail, wouldn't it be great to have flashcards that can speak for you?
Psychotherapist Nancy Dreyfus has come up with a tool to help partners connect or reconnect without speaking a word. Her new book is called Talk to Me Like I'm Someone You Love, Relationship Repair in a Flash. It offers relationship advice and comes with flashcards. Nancy joins us on the phone from Philadelphia. Welcome to Two Boomer Babes.
Oh, I'm thrilled to be here.
Nancy, tell us, how do you use these flashcards? I mean, if you're in a heated, you know, moment?
Well, I can't imagine anybody listening to this would ever be in the situation. But for those of you who are ever in a situation where you feel you are trying to get through to an impossible person, and it might even dawn on you that that person is seeing you as impossible, and it just feels, often a woman will think he is such a baby, and a guy is thinking, will she ever stop nagging? You go to the book, which you have already studied and circled, because whatever you were upset about a few days ago, I promise you will come up in the future. And you hold up a very readable flashcard. The new book has 127, and I'll give you some samples. This feels awful. Can we start again and really listen to each other? I can absolutely see why you'd be annoyed with me, but can you give me some sign that we're still friends? I love you. I hate fighting. And can't we just hug? And a favorite, you're not being crazy. I can see why you'd be upset with me. And I have to tell you, telling your partner that they're not crazy is extremely relieving.
Well, Nancy, I got to tell you, in theory, this sounds really great, but in the heat of the moment, how do you sift through all those cards? We have them right here, and figure out which one is appropriate.
Well, it's one of the two questions everybody asks. The other one is, like, do people really use them? And we'll get to that. My recommendation is that when you get the book, you simply, obviously, I want you to read the book. There's a card on every page and some field notes that tell you the best times to use them. If you simply go through the table of contents, I promise most readers that you will read a number of messages and think, God, I wish I had that a few days ago, and you circle them. Some people put tabs, and that probably a week from now when you find yourself in the same situation, you're going to be prepared.
And maybe you memorize the lines, too. I mean,
that's
after
another
a while.
Possibility. In other words, I don't want people to have to completely give up their voices. You know, I'm here to bring more emotional maturity to the planet. It's not that you have to be reliant on my cards, but when people see the book, and the cards are in the book, when people see them, almost always what they say to me is, God, why didn't anybody think this up before?
Well, Nancy, not to be the devil's advocate, but okay, I'm going to do that.
You can.
Okay, thank you. What if you this argument sparks and you say, hold a second, I'm going to go get my book and my flashcards, I'll be right back. I mean, it just seems
well, that would
to
defuse
sort of,
the situation right
that's
there,
true.
It seems like.
That's true.
You might
well,
forget
me,
what you were arguing about.
Let me say something. Let me just give you a perspective on it, because you're not the first person who has asked me this question, though usually it's men, not women. Imagine you need to go to the ATM machine and you need money. Do you leave because there are two people ahead of you? If you go to Starbucks and you want a latte, do you leave because when you walk in, it's not made for you? Now, listen to my thinking. How many hours a day do you complain and dray and obsess over your relationship? Hours. Hours. Anybody who's been in a relationship for more than a year has plenty to obsess about. And so it's the simple idea of making a choice that you're going to take 2 minutes. I mean, we're talking, gang, 2 minutes. To do something that's different, to give yourself, to remind yourself that you can get through to somebody. You know, we all have the experience of being in an incredibly cozy space with a partner, and it's unbelievable how one little thing can go wrong, and it can disintegrate. You know, somebody misses the point, somebody interrupts you.
Well, have you tried this technique in your own relationships? Has it worked for you?
I do, actually. There's a flashcard right now, I don't need a lecture. I need your love. Very popular under my roof. And my partner has crossed out lecture and written therapist. And it's actually over the bed. And we have the point and click. We have the point and click method. Yeah. Yeah, we do use it. And I can remember many, many years ago, I've been divorced for a number of years. I'm in a different relationship. And I remember my stepson years ago when my husband and I would bicker, scream, use your flashcards. So, of course, the trick, as you're pointing out, is to remember to use them.
So you kind of find the ones that you think work for you and sort of keep them in a
keep
close
them handy.
Place.
Yeah. keep close them to your chest.
Yeah. I mean, I think a very interesting point or an important point to make about this is that when you are in an upset with a loved one or with really anyone, something called your fight or flight response kicks in. It's a mechanism to protect you. And how we begin working is we begin scanning for danger. So if you and I were having, one of you and I were having an upset, and in the middle of it I said, you know, I'm really sorry, you'd hear the words, but your scanning mechanism would hear the 4% exasperation in my voice. And so the beauty of the flashcard, why they're so powerful, is because there's no voice tone. There's nothing diluting the purity of the message. And if you think about most upsets you've had with people you've loved, it's really because you want to be close. You want to be heard. You want to be understood. So let's go right to the heart of the matter and connect.
Well, when we come back, more with Nancy Dreyfuss, author of Talk to Me Like I'm Someone You Love, Stay with us. We'll be right back after the break.
Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6, I make his breakfast. Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6, I make his breakfast. At 7, I shower. Every day I wake up at 5.
For those caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community to help us better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
This is Kathy and Barb, the Two Boomer Babes. We're continuing our conversation with psychotherapist Nancy Dreyfus. She advocates using relationship flashcards to express our thoughts when we can't find the right words or tone. Nancy, these flashcards are organized by themes for specific situations, and one of the themes is getting clarification.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that.
Often, you know, when we are feeling really plugged in, we can confuse reality. I mean, we often confuse reality. And getting clarification, some of the flashcards from that section are, when you treat me this way, it feels like you don't respect me. Is that true? When you say things like that, it feels like you're thinking of ending the relationship. In other words, it's actually requiring your partner to take some responsibility for themselves.
Hmm. Okay, and then you also have flashcards. Now, this one stumped me a little bit. For when a partner feels threatened, for example, one of the cards we picked out of there said, "I'm feeling very scared of you right now." Mm-hmm. I mean, I would think you would need more than a flashcard to, if you're really scared of your partner, like maybe like call 911 or run.
Well, you know, it's interesting. One of the things you learn in psychotherapy school is that when you're with somebody who's very belligerent, to always think of the words little and big, that the person who's very belligerent is actually feeling small and having to act powerful because they see you as big, and they tell you, if you're actually ever with a really violent person, get down on the floor and say, "Oh, I'm so scared of you," because you're immediately changing the dynamic. If the person who is scaring you sees that you're scared, it allows them to feel big and therefore allows them to feel less threatened. I'm presuming that most of the people using these cards are not dealing with a violent predator.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the truth of the matter is, by the time, you know, you've bought these cards, you're probably, if you're with somebody who you are actually worried about being physically abusive, you probably shouldn't be with that person. I tell people that there's a card, "I feel like a total and complete idiot." It's a very unusual person who will see you acknowledge that, even an emotionally out-of-touch person who doesn't melt, so that if somebody really sees you being vulnerable and making a peace offering and does nothing, I mean, you may be with a psychopath.
Nancy, let me ask you, what if your partner is just not into using these flashcards?
Like my husband
yeah,
would
I mean,
think I'm nuts.
I just can't imagine our husbands, you know, "Here, guys, here are the flashcards. I want you to use them."
It's funny. I've never heard a man say to me, "What if my wife doesn't want to use them?"
Really? The guys want to use them?
Well, I'm saying that you don't hear that. Usually it's women who think their husbands or their partners won't. But this is the thing. I would agree. I would not go to a resistant man and say, "Honey, here's this great idea." In other words, I wouldn't sit, as much as I love my flashcards, I wouldn't sit and advise you to have a philosophical discussion on the value of them. I would wait till there was an upset, and I would just come and flash a card that you know will melt your partner's heart, such as, "I can see that I've missed the point. Please give me another chance. I realize I'm overreacting. Can you give me a minute to get sane again?" And, you know, most men will be thrilled if you just say, "I know I've been relentless. I can understand why you'd want to get away from me." Once somebody feels like you're understanding their predicament, they're not going to argue with you about the value of the cards, because underneath it all, what do people really want? They want to be heard, seen, and felt.
Do you say anything while you're flashing the card, or do you just let the card speak for you?
The best thing is to say not a word.
Wow.
So I think we should do picture cards for the guys.
Yes, but they have to come in big print, because my husband has very bad eyesight. So that's your next venture.
Well, what I just want to say to people while we're here and there, if you go to Nancy Dreyfus, DREYFUS.com, you can actually download, certainly, you know, I'm thrilled if people order the book, but you can actually download some free flashcards and try them out and see how they work.
We're going to do that. Nancy Dreyfus, author of Talk to Me Like I'm Someone You Love, thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
It's a pleasure, one boomer to two others.
Up next, a career diplomat turns mystery writer. Guess who the main character is modeled after? We'll be right back after the break.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Support comes from Accent on Travel Rehoboth Beach with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m., I shower. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m., I shower. I start laundry at 8. At 10, we go for a walk. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m.
For those dealing with the daily struggles of caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community with experts and other caregivers for advice, tips, and support. Together, let's help each other better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Bill Shepherd was a career diplomat in the American Foreign Service, having been posted in Singapore, Saigon, Budapest, Athens, and retiring as Consul General in Bordeaux.
Not bad postings.
Not at all. Which is why I found it ironic that he would want to reinvent himself after all the glitz, glamour, and interesting diplomatic negotiations. Well, sitting before us in our Washington, D.C. studio is diplomatic mystery writer Bill Shepherd. Welcome to Two Boomer Babes.
Thank you so much, Kathy and Barb. It's great to be with you.
You served in some really active embassies that gave you great material for your books, and you met some really fascinating people along the way, including Cardinal Mindszenty of Budapest, who actually sought asylum in the embassy. Tell us a story.
Yes, he had been sentenced to life in prison in a trumped-up trial, and when the 1956 Hungarian Revolution came, he was suddenly freed, but that freedom was ephemeral. He came to our mission and was admitted, and it was 15 years before he was able to leave and go out to Austria. Actually, he was a very, very brave man. His actual given name was not Mindszenty at all. It was Bém, Joseph Bém. Nothing more Germanic than that in that part of the world. Many Hungarians, seeing the rise of the Nazi power, wanted to change their names to something German.
Exactly.
He saw them coming, would not associate with those barbarians, and changed his name to the little town where he lived, All Saints, Mindszent. Hmm. That's how he became Mindszenty before he was Cardinal Mindszenty. An admirable thing to do.
Well, that must have really been fascinating, having him with you, you know, in the embassy and with your family.
Absolutely. Occasionally, he would give a religious service. And let me mention, when we came back to Washington on one of our five tours here, and Washington is the most exotic capital in the world, I must say, I was once driving my eldest daughter, Stephanie, down to school, and I said, Steph, now, what do you remember most about Budapest? And she said, well, I remember that Christmas day when my sister Robin and I walked in the snow in the embassy courtyard with that wonderful man with the scarlet robes, and he gave us some chocolate bars when it was over. She was talking about our Christmas Day walk with Cardinal Mincenti in the embassy courtyard.
Not many people can say that, I'm sure.
Wow.
And then years later, didn't you actually have the privilege of testifying for his canonization?
Yes, I did. And I was looked up when I was Consul General in Bordeaux. I was looked up by a Father Fusaire, who was in Detroit, who was putting together the case for, I suppose, beatification to begin with. And he looked me up and asked if I would give testimony. I said, I'd be happy to. I don't happen to be Roman Catholic. He said, that makes no difference at all. And so I was part of this wonderful procedure, and I gave testimony as to my knowledge of His Eminence, and I was later told that that was helpful. It helped fill in a gap that they didn't have the testimony for. So I was pleased to do that, and I hope that that works out. It's always good to have friends on high.
It sure is.
And rumor has it that you actually met along the way some other very interesting characters, including Ann Landers and Elizabeth Taylor.
Surely.
Oh, boy, tell us about it.
Surely,
must have been fascinating.
Not at the same time. Ann Landers was in Saigon when I was the special assistant to Ambassador Henry Cabot Lodge during the Vietnam War. Everybody came there. You know, the book for Casablanca's Everybody Comes to Rick's. Well, in the 60s, everybody came to Saigon. Not only Ann Landers, I met General Omar Bradley, who was the greatest celebrity I've ever met. I mean, Omar Bradley walked into the room and you stood.
Wow.
You just stood, because that's what one did. He was a marvelous person. I also met many other celebrities there, including Charles Lindbergh.
Oh, ooh. Very fascinating.
Elizabeth Taylor we met in Budapest because her husband was filming Bluebeard at the time.
Which husband? It must have been Richard Burton.
It was Richard Burton.
Uh-huh.
The first marriage, if I remember correctly. I got into serious trouble with my wife Lois, though, because she asked me afterwards, did you notice those wonderful jewels Elizabeth Taylor, who was my dinner partner, was wearing? And I said, what jewels? I said, but I can tell you those eyes really are violet.
Okay. Well, I thought you meant jewels and other things.
Well, I think it's good that you noticed the eyes and not maybe something a little bit lower. This is the Two Boomer Babes, and we are speaking with career diplomat, author, historian, and wine expert Bill Shepherd. Bill, you served with some pretty high-profile ambassadors, and who was your favorite?
It depended upon where you were, because it varies. It's kind of a moving target. I would say my favorite, as far as sheer professional is concerned, would be Ellsworth Bunker. Ellsworth Bunker followed Henry Cabot Lodge as ambassador in Saigon. He was a captain of industry in the sugar trade and got a political appointment as ambassador. He was so good that he kept being reappointed for his ambassador for 20 years. And he was extremely professional. We worked very, very hard for him, but you didn't feel pressed. You felt like you were all part of a team. He was extremely thorough and just a fine man to work for.
Well, let's switch gears. And I know you used a lot of your experience overseas with your writing and your mystery series. Now, your stories are created around a person named Robbie Cutler, a 30-something career diplomat. And this is a really silly question, Bill, but is Robbie's character possibly modeled after you?
Well, I think there are some similarities there. First, let me say that this is a family effort in that Robbie Robinson is a family name as far as we're concerned, and Cutler is the maiden name of my wife's mother. So we kind of put them together.
And he happens to be very dashing and handsome.
Yes.
I'm sure, like you are.
Yes.
Well, let me say that he is very logical, and he places are not foreign to him. He's at home about anywhere. I think I'm somewhat of that. He's also fairly logical and not as intuitive as he might be, probably like me, and that's where his girlfriend Sylvie comes along in order to straighten him out. Lois and I used to say after cocktail receptions in the diplomatic service, we'd leave and I'd tell her what was going on politically, and she would tell me who was fighting with whom and everything else, all of the real stuff that was going on at the reception, because she picked up those vibrations which were foreign to me.
Oh, well, it sounds like Robbie's girlfriend is Lois, your wife.
Did we make that connection right, Bill?
Well, perhaps part of that. Perhaps part of that. But the girlfriend, you know, in Vintage Murder, the girlfriend, Heavens, in the next book, Murder on the Danube, modeled after our Hungarian experience, they are engaged to be married. Well, and then there's a honeymoon coming up in Murder in Dordogne.
Oh, really?
Well, I did want to ask you about that. How did all the fascinating people that you met and the marvelous places that you lived, how did all of those experiences impact your writing?
Oh, to a considerable degree. Factually, the places that I've been in, and obviously we have here Bordeaux and we have Budapest, there is Prague as well. All of those are realistically part of the background, and I set them forth. However, it's very tricky to do that because you can remember, if you've been in the Foreign Service, another capital, and if you write about it 20 years later, you're writing about something that probably still doesn't exist. So with each place, I would go back, and I'd take the temperature, find out what was going on now in order to make sure that what I was writing was still accurate and not a trick of memory.
Yeah. Well, darn the luck to have to go back to Bordeaux, Budapest, you know. I can think of worse places to just have to visit.
If you need an assistant, we're available.
Yeah. We'll take the show on the road.
Well, you were a diplomat a few years ago, but we read so many headlines these days about the dangers of being a Foreign Service officer mm-hmm. and being in embassies. You know, for example, of course, the ambassador that was recently killed in Libya.
Sure.
Do you think it's a lot more dangerous to be a diplomat these days, you know, than when you served, I mean, after all, with Al-Qaeda and mm-hmm. post 9/11? Or mm-hmm. was it not publicized like it is now?
I don't think it was publicized as much as it is now. It's quite fashionable to talk about terrorism and so forth. Unfortunately, there are plaques in the Department of State where there are American diplomats over the many years who have lost their lives. I remember when I was in Bordeaux, good old comfortable Bordeaux. I was going to take a trip, an official trip up to Limoges and so on. And it was a Sunday afternoon, and I decided to leave early. Yeah, just leave a day early. I'm not quite sure why, so I did. I went off, and then I went to my appointment a day or so later in the city of Limoges. And there was a message waiting for me to call a security officer at the embassy in Paris. I did. My colleague, the consul general in Strasbourg, had been shot 5 times. They were unsure as to whether this was a dual plot or not. There had been absolutely no warning, nothing of that sort. The trouble with diplomacy and security is, to some extent, they don't go together. You have to be able to get out and talk to people, or you're really not doing your job. You can't do it from a fortress. On the other hand, if you're not in a fortress, you're not going to be safe. So this is part of the risks of the game that unfortunately are part of today's diplomacy.
And that's the dilemma facing the State Department these days, for sure.
Very much so.
You know, I was overseas in Liberia, and we were posted to an embassy, and we were in coups and shot at and everything else. And, you know, that was pre-9/11. So. Yeah. I think things just have not been as in the news, you know, as they are now.
And we were stationed in the Philippines when the Americans were captured in Iran. And boy, that was really a very volatile time for Americans to be in that part of the world. It was
They don't give danger pay for nothing over
no.
there. That's for
well,
sure.
Well, we didn't get, we were in the Peace Corps. We didn't get danger pay. We got $200 a month, like it or leave it.
If you could go back to a post bill real quickly, which one would you relive?
Well, I'm owed a trip to Bordeaux. I think we really should go back there for a while. I do have a book out on French wines as well, which is, let me say, the bestseller for an e-book in both the United States and the United Kingdom. And I love to taste those various vintages and wines and so forth. We still have a lot of friends in Bordeaux. And that would be great fun to go back and compare notes with people.
Career diplomat and mystery writer Bill Shepard, thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes. And remember, we're available to go to Bordeaux anytime.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so very much.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Support comes from Accent on Travel Rehoboth Beach with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m., I shower. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m., I shower. I start laundry at 8. At 10, we go for a walk. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m.
For those dealing with the daily struggles of caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community with experts and other caregivers for advice, tips, and support. Together, let's help each other better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
This is the news. This morning, we are saluting the 2.2 million women who have joined in the war effort. They now make up 37% of the workforce, changing their role forever.
The prestigious Harvard Medical School is breaking ground today, opening its doors to new female applicants.
Today, little girls all over the world look to the sky, where the first woman is now in space.
Military stereotypes are challenged today with the trailblazing promotion of a U.S. female officer to four-star general. It was just announced that the vast majority of last year's doctorate degrees were earned by women.
We've come so far, but our news is changing for the worse. More women die from heart disease and stroke than men, even though it can be prevented. Make a change at GoRedForWomen.org today. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the American Heart Association's Go Red for Women.
Who might you save?
Your mother, your father, your husband, uncle, aunt, son.
Learn FAST, F-A-S-T, the sudden signs of a stroke, and you could save...
your friend, your best friend, teacher, boss, coach.
F, face drooping. A, arm weakness. S, speech difficulty. T, time to call 911. F-A-S-T, face, arm, speech, time. That's F, face drooping. A, arm weakness. S, speech difficulty. T, time to call 911. The sooner they get to the hospital, the sooner they'll get treatment. And that can make a remarkable difference in the recovery of...
your neighbor, the waiter, a fellow shopper, a total stranger, grandmother, grandfather.
So learn FAST, the sudden signs of a stroke, then pass it on, because you never know who might save you.
Your wife, your colleague, teammate, mother.
Spot a stroke fast. Visit strokeassociation.org. Brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
When traveling in a foreign land, it's always helpful to know a few choice phrases in the local language. Of course, there are the must-haves like, how much does it cost? Or where's the bathroom? But what if we want to express ourselves in a different sort of way, perhaps in the universal language of swearing?
Jason Sacker has come up with an international glossary of some of the world's most strangely offensive slurs. They're all in his book, How to Swear Around the World. Whether it's to defame someone's mother or tell them they were raised by animals, Jason says it's hard to translate insults and idiomatic expressions, but it can become true poetry. Who knew? He joins us on the phone from Portland, Maine, to shoot the breeze with the babes. Welcome to the show, Jason.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Well, what was so interesting about your book to me was so many of these words or phrases that sound so benign in English can be very, very offensive in another culture. For example, calling someone a turtle is really offensive in China, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's really fascinating. There's so many of those. And the sort of etymology of how you get to turtle being offensive is becomes vaguely pornographic, and I'll leave the imagination sort of run with it. But there's all these sorts of little things like that throughout different languages. You know, I mean, in Arab cultures, you have touching a head with a shoe is like an incredibly insulting gesture because shoes are considered very dirty, and so you can, you know, send a curse of a shoe upon someone in Arab cultures. There's so many of those. It was really fascinating, for sure.
Well, let's talk about some of the more unusual words or phrases and the least offensive. For example, to get rid of that pesky hanger-on in Brazil, we would tell them to go dig for potatoes. I mean, wow. How come that's so offensive?
It's funny. My girlfriend is from Brazil, and so I actually got that from her mother. My take of it is it's sort of like the, you know, because Brazil is such a rural agrarian country, or, you know, traditionally was, there's this sense of sort of the peasants versus the city people. And it's basically kind of a way of saying, you're a peasant, get out of here. Mm. You know, there's a lot of that, you know, a lot of class culture kind of stuff, especially, say, in like Japanese culture. One of my favorites is in Japanese culture is just simply the word you, as in Y-O-U. You have, just like as in French, you can say a very familiar, you know, if it's your family, you use T-U for you. And if it's, you know, a colleague at work, you would say vous, V-O-U-S. Japan, there's tons of different ways to just say you. And the most offensive is kisama.
Huh.
And it's incredibly offensive to call someone. It's very, basically, to say that is basically like you're telling them they're dirty, worthless. But all you're actually really saying is you.
Now, speaking of offensive, every culture seems to take offense when someone speaks ill of our mothers. You know, we all have our share of standard mom insults.
Yeah.
But one of the more head-scratching ones is the Welsh expression, your mother is an old wood pigeon. I mean, the old part I kind of think is offensive, but I don't get the wooden pigeon thing. So can you explain that real quickly?
I wish I could. It's one of those things that just sort of dribbles down maybe from the Middle Ages. I'm trying to think of an example in English where the meaning of it gets sort of filtered down and lost over the years.
Well, Jason, you know, finally, what's your all-time favorite insult? But you've got to keep it PG, you know.
Oh, of course, of course. Well, one of my favorites is I love the ones that speak to the history of a culture or even something, you know, not so terribly nice in a culture. But one of my favorites is in Hindi, I guess there's a curse where you say to someone, may you have 100 daughters. Because in traditional Indian culture, you would have to pay the dowry on your daughters as they get married. And so to have to pay 100 dowries. So it's just a sort of like backhanded financial curse.
Well, as a mother of daughters, we take offense at that. Although we don't have 100 of them.
Well, I know. Thank goodness for the end of the dowry. That's
right.
For sure.
Well, Jason Sacker, author of How to Swear Around the World, this has been very educational. Thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Take care.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Racking your brain about where to take your next vacation? Why not build a trip around some aspect of your family's genealogy? After all, where we come from says a lot about our present and just might explain a few things about those crazy relatives on Dad's side.
Travel guru Deb Stone is back with the babes to shoot the breeze about planning your next genealogical travel adventure. Welcome, Deb.
Oh, thanks for having me. Good to talk to you, babes.
Hey, so is there a growing trend towards roots travel? I mean, especially among us boomers?
Yes, you know what? I think, first of all, most Americans' ancestors are immigrants from somewhere, so it's really natural to wonder about where we come from and why. But the increased interest, I think, has to do with a few things. One is actually the NBC show, Who Do You Think You Are? I don't know if you know that show. The one that's traced the histories of a lot of celebrities, and they go on these personal journeys, and they reveal that many of us have these fascinating tidbits buried that deep in our past. But that's been one of the reasons for the popularity. But I also think it's retiring boomers with more time to travel that has definitely generated increased interest.
Well, I'm on Ancestry.com, and I'm just sure I'm keep looking for my rich relatives in Ireland with the castle. I'm just sure we have one somewhere.
Well, good luck with that, huh?
Thank you.
And, you know, mine came over on the Mayflower via Russia.
She's so important.
Like detour, right?
Exactly, a little detour. So, Deb, say I'll pick a country, Germany, to check out the village where my grandparents came from. What's involved? How much research should I do before I set off for the old country?
Well, I think really, that depends on the individual. First of all, I think it depends on whether you really enjoy doing that kind of research by yourself or whether you'd like to have assistance in doing it. But in any case, you're going to want to, of course, put in as much information as you can at one of those wonderful websites that you just mentioned. Ancestry.com, in fact, is the largest genealogy website in the world. But there are several others, such as archives.com, genealogy.com, and then RootsWeb. RootsWeb is free. The others do have charges associated with them. But really, it just depends on how much research one wants to do. You can enter all the information, as I said, and see what comes up. But if you do come to places where you are stuck or where you can't go any further, then you want to probably enlist the help of someone, a company, a tour company that could help you, or else going to one of those places like the Family History Library in Salt Lake City or the National Archives in D.C.
Well, what are these companies? They're actually genealogy tour companies? What are they?
Yes. In fact, there's several that have sprung up in the recent years. One in particular, you know, most of them do the personalized, individualized tours. But this particular company, I've noticed, Family Tree Tours, offers not only the private tours, but group genealogy tours. So they are pre-planned tours with flexibility of taking independent day trips to explore your hometown or visit your relatives, as well as including all sorts of events and cultural types of activities. And they provide contacts for these professionals, these European heritage professionals in your ancestral hometown who meet you and escort you on your visit, as well as provide you with a family tree research help.
Wow. And gives you the key to the castle.
Absolutely.
She is such a has rose-colored glasses over there.
I do.
I've given up. Dream on, girl.
Yeah, exactly. Really. Might as well think high, you know.
Exactly. Well, Deb, how much are these tours? Say we go with a group tour. How much can we expect to pay for this?
Well, you mentioned Germany. So, for example, the company I just mentioned, Family Tree Tours, does a Northwest Germany tour. I think it's 10 or 11 days, and it's probably in the neighborhood of about $2,500, which includes some meals. It includes internal company country transportation, entrance fees, expert help, your hotel. Of course, your airfare over there you are responsible for. But that gives you some ideas. They also do tours to the Black Forest in Germany. And then, speaking of Ireland, they do an Irish Heritage Tour, which is close in the same amount of price range, about 10 or 11 days and about $2,300 per person.
Hmm. Oh, that sounds like such fun.
And I'm thinking these group tours, you might meet like a long-lost cousin that's looking for the same village.
Absolutely. And, you know, these people are connecting, you know, because they have that goal and that interest in finding out maybe where their great-great-grandfather lived or maybe even finding their long-lost cousins.
Right. And they might own a castle, Kathy.
See? I think we ought to book it tomorrow.
I think that's absolutely perfect. Well, Deb Stone, our go-to guru, thanks so much for sharing your always fabulous travel tips with the Two Boomer Babes.
Thanks for having me, Gail.
And now it's time for us babes to give credit where credit is due.
Audio and technical guru Julio Gonzalez, who magically pulls it all together.
Webmaster wizard Gail Jane, who makes TwoBoomerBabes.com a fab place to visit.
Founding members of the Chicago chapter of the Two Boomer Babes Supper Club, Mike and Larry Israel, for your unfailing love and support.
Our husbands, daughters, family, and friends, even with smirks and eye rolls, who encourage us all the way.
And give us great material, often without knowing it.
Our moms and upstairs directors, Jane and Sally, who are cheering us on from their bridge game in the sky.
Our home away from home, Delmarva Public Radio. And to you, our listeners, for joining us each week and spurring us on.
Two Boomer Babes is a production of Two Boomer Babes Media in collaboration with Zimer Communications.
Can you think of anything else? I'm glad other people don't remember. That's all I can say. Okay, here we go. Yeah, really. To listen to the entire interview, visit twoboomerbabes.com.